طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. The main purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham, and we continue it in his memory. This is John Roberts. Again recently, Israel and the United States exercised their bully status at the United Nations by trashing and ultimately forcing the withdrawal from the UN website, a report by Richard Falk and Virginia Tilley that they had commissioned concerning a serious academic study which examined the question of apartheid in Israel. Does it or does it not exist? The moment that the report was issued, which affirmed that apartheid as defined by the UN's own protocols of apartheid does indeed exist in Israel-Palestine according to the objective data, the attacks began. This morning we feature a speech by one of the authors of the report, Virginia Tilley, who meticulously defines the process of the study as well as its conclusions. Virginia Tilley recently spoke at Harvard University via Skype as part of the Anti-Apartheid Week's presentation sponsored by the Harvard-Palestine Solidarity Committee. Virginia Tilley is professor of political science at the University of Southern Illinois, where she focuses on the comparative study of racial and ethnic conflict. The study she authored with Richard Falk is titled Israeli Practices Toward the Palestinian People and the Question of Apartheid. Here is Professor Virginia Tilley speaking at Harvard University.
I am really honored to be here. Thank you so much for the invitation. I want to thank the Palestinian Solidarity Committee and particularly Hala Ahmed, who did contact me originally, and what I think is a wonderful group of people who are working hard on this week of events. It's a privilege to be talking with you about this issue. It is a sensitive issue. I'm very sensitive to that. It is, however, the time that we should undertake it seriously. The term has been arising, as some of you may know, increasingly in polemics and debate about the conflict in various forms, not least cautions by Israeli prime ministers that if Israel doesn't change its policies, it will find itself in a relationship to the Palestinians, particularly those under occupation, that would amount to apartheid. Prime Minister Olmert, when he was prime minister, in fact, made a very strong caution that if the Palestinians shifted to an anti-apartheid struggle under these conditions, it would be the end of Israel. He was very worried about this because he saw the direction things were going. And as more people began to become concerned about this, including Israelis, it was the Economic and Social Commission of West Asia that undertook to try to get an authoritative legal analysis of the question. Whether this is a case of apartheid or going toward a case of apartheid, and what that would mean. And they commissioned Dr. Falk to work on it, and I had already been working on this question in South Africa in regard to the occupied territories, and I had invited Dr. Falk to my university to speak, and we were talking about it, and I said, well, by jingo, I've worked on this quite a lot. The study we did on whether Israel's policies in the occupied territories amounted to apartheid was a massive study. It took a year and a half to do with a team of lawyers. If you're interested, I refer you to that publication that came out with Pluto in 2012 as under the title Beyond Occupation. And it's a very thorough legal analysis. It for those of you who are interested in international law, I highly recommend it. For those of you who are not, I wouldn't necessarily recommend it because it's so dense. It's not particularly user-friendly for the non-specialist. But with that background, I suggested to Richard that I might be helpful to the study, and he warmly agreed, was very gracious about that, and we ended up collaborating on it. And I found it an extraordinary experience. It was a tremendous task with a great moral responsibility, so we undertook it with a lot of care. With that context, let me talk a little bit about why this has become so important. We have seen since 1967, which is now 50 years ago, no progress at all in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. There has been no withdrawal by Israel from the territories occupied in 1967. In referring to the West Bank and Gaza Strip and East Jerusalem. Instead, we've seen a massive settlement growth in the West Bank particularly, which has now transplanted something like closing on 500,000 Jewish settlers in this territory, which is counterintuitive to giving it back, right? I mean, if you want to give a territory back, you don't move civilians into it. It also was puzzling because it actually increases Israel's insecurity to be putting civilians in what would seem to be harm's way. So something else must be going on. And it became clear to all that withdrawing the settlements was essential to some kind of territorial arrangement for the Palestinians, whether that was autonomy or a state. Eventually that became clarified as a state, and yet there was no territorial conditions for a state. So the question is why this is happening. I mean, if Israel wants peace, if Israel is not intending to annex the West Bank, if there's going to be a two-state solution in the long run, why is Israel expanding the settlements with such dedication and speed? And we should also be clear on that this is not something that can be traced to some zealots, right? It's not a religious zealot project. It's a state project. All the ministries are involved. In fact, some of the ministries' entire budgets are involved. They are dedicated to the settlement. So what's going on? Why is this happening? It's counterintuitive. It doesn't make sense. It goes against the logic. I'm going to dip a little bit for a moment into academies here because I had the pleasure of stumbling over a book that some of you might have heard of, Thomas Kuhn's work on what he called a paradigm shift. It's an old book now, but I went back and looked at it, and I was really struck by his analysis, which in his case was about physics, and which is far afield. But the question here is why we have there's an anomaly. Why we expect something to happen and it's not happening? There's an anomaly. What's going on? There's something wrong with our assumptions. Now, social systems don't work the way physics do, but it's still something that needs to be explained. And it became clear to some of us that Israel's interest in annexing this land was going beyond what people had appreciated. There were reasons behind it that were not fully understood by a lot of people, and that if we began to think about it more clearly, we would, or maybe through a different lens, we would begin to understand the conflict in a different light, and then it would make sense. What was clear was that in the occupied territories, and by that I mean the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem, there was no solution being crafted. The occupation, the military occupation, was going on and on, and it was designed to prevent Palestinians from having any engagement with any access to civil liberties. Palestinians in these territories live under military law. Whatever anybody wants to say about it, whether there's an occupation or not, I think it's pretty clear there is an occupation when you go there and you see that it's all run by the Israeli army, and that people's daily lives are ruled by military orders. That's how it works. And I haven't gotten to Oslo yet, so I will do that. I will mention that later because that was an attempt to alter that a bit. But it still looked like a plan for permanency. And the condition of Palestinians living in these occupied territories were therefore very indeterminate. The only way to get them out of that situation seemed to be to create a state, and Israel was making that territorially impossible to do. The draconian separation in the West Bank of the Jewish separate population and the Palestinian population was the first part that drew people's attention and started raising this word apartheid. It was an impressionistic term. People were seeing the wall, for example, this giant edifice that was designed forcibly to separate Jewish communities from Palestinian communities in the name of security. But in effect, when the people have reviewed the wall, including the International Court of Justice, they've seen that it is a strategic operation it does have to do with security, but it also has to do with land control. And the segregation of highways, where certain highways are dedicated to use by Jewish settlers and are really not accessible by Palestinians, and Palestinians have a kind of a separate road system, dual legal system in the same territory where Palestinians, as I mentioned, are subject to military law, and Jewish settlers are subject to civil law. By the way, important here is that Jewish settlers are subject to Israeli civil law even if they're not citizens. All it requires is that they're Jewish settlers. So it's an explicitly ethnic division. This problem of the segregation, that it began to look more and more explicitly racial, and I have to pause here over the term racial. Racial is not a term that we normally use for Palestinians and Jews today, thankfully. The days when we talked in those terms about groups are happily receding into the past. But in international law, the prohibition of racial discrimination quite intelligently includes discrimination on the basis of a number of identities, descent, ethnic or national origin, for example, color. And this is, I think, very, as I said, it's an intelligent formula because it captures the different language that people use to discriminate against groups. Notably Jews. I think in some ways it reflected a very able handling of anti-Semitism, which is sometimes expressed in racial terms, as the Nazis did, and sometimes as ethnic terms, and sometimes in some kind of other essentialist terms. And what the international law says about the prohibition of racial discrimination is that all of those are prohibited. All of those count as racial discrimination for the purposes of international law. So we have to, this is one of the places where we have to separate our kind of common language and the way that we talk about things from the technical language that arises in law that's been developed in order to handle these complicated issues. So when I say that the wall or the dual highway system or the dual court system or these the segregation, forced segregation in the West Bank, particularly, was starting to look like racial discrimination. I don't mean that the groups are racial, what we talk today more and more like apartheid. Apartheid wasn't in South Africa, wasn't explicitly racial system. But in, as I said, in international law, racial gets this broader understanding of how it can be expressed. I think in this case, principally according to descent, ideas of descent, that you're Jewish because you're descended from Jews, and you are Palestinian because you're descended from Palestinians, and of course then we get into conversion, and there's complications here, but Israel's Declaration of Independence explicitly says that the right of the Jewish people to this land derives from the ancient kingdoms that were there in biblical times. So that's an explicit invocation of descent, central to Israel's state building and nation building project. I realize I'm kind of drawing a lot of threads together. I hope I'm not losing you that, but I think they'll come together as I go on. So we saw this language is starting to arise. Apartheid wall, apartheid robes, acts of apartheid, elements of apartheid. Then you have the, as I mentioned, the Israeli prime minister saying we're heading for apartheid. John Kerry in the United States said if we don't do something, this is going to become apartheid. So it was in this context that we undertook the study. Okay, is it apartheid? Because that's very grave. It would be a grave, puts in called in international law, grave breach of human rights law. But in undertaking to do a study like that, the first thing we had to do was to separate out all the kind of peripheral definitions of apartheid that arose. The people use apartheid in lots of ways around the world, just as they use the word genocide rather than slavery these days, which is fine for the purposes that they're undertaking. But when you're talking about law and you're talking about what states have signed on to and what obligations they have under law, then you have to get specific. And in this case, the law is expressed in two places. One is the Convention on the Suppression and Punishment of the Crime of Apartheid, which was the great convention imposed during the struggle against apartheid in South Africa. It was designed to be a universal instrument. And in international law, that means it applies anywhere. It's not confined to South Africa. It's a law that prohibits apartheid wherever it may arise. Much later, the prohibition of apartheid was expressed in the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, which took a long time to put together. So much more recently, we have a kind of reiteration of this, that it is not only a bad thing and a violation of human rights, but it's a crime against humanity. And the Convention on the Suppression and Punishment of the Crime of Apartheid also says that it's a crime, punishable. So these were the places that we took as our guiding light. In the report, there's a section that talks about the other usages of apartheid and explains why it is that we have stuck to this definition very narrowly. Because we were talking with a commission to do this by the United Nations group, and the implications were what do United Nations member states have to do if it is apartheid. So it was proper to use a United Nations convention for this purpose. So that's the background to all of this. Then we had to get serious. Well, we take this definition, and what do we do with it? How do we operationalize it? What's the method? The definition in the convention, what I call the Apartheid Convention, with that long, cumbersome, typical UN name, is much longer than the Rome Statute one, and it's much more detailed. And it has a little list of things that it says would be crimes of apartheid if they are practiced for the purpose of maintaining the domination of one racial group or groups over any other group or groups. So this is an interesting definition. It says, well, it's a crime, but only if it's done for the purpose of domination. You could do all of these things anyway, and they wouldn't be for the purpose of domination. It's hard to imagine doing some of these things if the purpose was not domination, but in any case, that what that means is you have to first establish that it's domination, and then look at the practices. So the first thing we had to establish was that Israel has, as a state, a project to affirm the domination of Jewish citizens. And the way Israeli doctrine works, that means Jews globally, but we'll stick with citizens for the moment. The Jewish citizens of the state will dominate the state. That the Jewish character, now this character is a very fuzzy word, but this is often used in the language of the discussions about Israel, that it should have a Jewish character. And this has been enshrined in some Israeli laws. Israel doesn't have a constitution. Some countries don't. Britain does, for example. There's a series of basic law that provides a constitutional framework for the country. And in several of the basic laws of Israel, it is stipulated that Israel is a Jewish and democratic state. So the Declaration of Independence of Israel, the Basic Laws of Israel, and several institutional arrangements, such as the Jewish National Fund, the Israeli Lands Authority, are all linked in with each other to the state under this doctrine. This is not controversial, this is all written out. I don't think anybody in Israel would deny any of this, that something like the Jewish National Fund is dedicated to the Jewish nation and Jewish national interests, and the aim of it, but then you link that to public institutions such as the Israel Lands Authority, which handles state land, and you find that public policy is linked institutionally and legally to the principle of maintaining Israel as a Jewish state. Now, what is a Jew is a big question. I won't get into that now. If someone wants to ask about that, we can talk about that maybe, but Israel has defined it for Israel's purposes by the law of return, and it is partly as a descendant. So the purpose of maintaining the domination of Jewishness in Israel is pretty easily established, and that was the easiest part of the court, because Israel doesn't deny that. In fact, Israel advertises that. This is the home of Jewish people, it has a Jewish character, it is a Jewish state. Okay, so there's a purpose there. Now, does that imply the need for domination over other groups or groups? Well, it does if you're a democracy, because if you have people who can vote out those laws that establish Israel, the Jewish state, you imperil the Jewish state. You imperil the Jewish quality of the state. And that means that you would need to make sure that nothing could ever assault those laws. No democratic legislative mechanism could ever change those basic laws of Israel's Jewish state. I hope you're following me here. And if I sound a little repetitious, it's because I'm just trying to make sure that the pieces come together. Then you look at, okay, well, what is the population that we're dealing with here in this area? Now, I'm going to use the term Mandate Palestine when I'm talking here, and by that I just mean the geography that now we all take for granted, that Israel, there was a territory established way back in around World War I, by the League of Nations, the British took over this territory, and it was given certain boundaries, and within those boundaries, everything is played out. The War of 48, the War of 67, the occupation of Israel's recognition as a state within the boundaries it established in 48, through war. And so the occupied territories are all part of the territory within this thing called Mandate Palestine, the original Palestine Mandate that was established back in 1922. Again, there's a history to that, but we don't need to get into that. Within this territory, you now have millions of Palestinians. Some of them are citizens of the state, some of them are residents of Jerusalem, some of them are living in the occupied territories. These are three categories. They live under three different legal regimes. In polemics on the conflict, where, you know, by polemics I just mean, you know, the ordinary language that people are throwing back and forth in arguments about it, without necessarily taking the scholarly or legal definition of it, which is fine, but for our purposes, as I said, we need to be legalistic about this. In polemics, you know, it isn't an apartheid state. People who are angry with Israel say it is an apartheid state. Israel's defenders say instantly it is not an apartheid state, and it's the reason that they give is because Palestinian citizens of Israel have a right to vote. There's other reasons they give, but that's the principal one. And the analogy is immediately drawn to South Africa, where black South Africans did not have to vote under apartheid. So you have that category. You have 300,000-ish Palestinians living in Jerusalem who have a completely different status. They're not citizens of the state. They are residents of Jerusalem. In most ways, that's the same status as any permanent resident might have. Let's say I went to Israel and I didn't want to stay, and I was eventually granted permanent residency status, and then it would be the same status. It's not quite that way. There are special, Israel has recognized that there are special ties of this population to Jerusalem and has provided certain, kind of a special category of permanent residency for them. But it is insecure. They can lose it. It is made insecure on the basis of essentially making trouble. I mean, if people resist Israel's policies or challenge the Jewish character of the state, they may find their house gone and confiscated and themselves deported to the West Bank. So it's an interesting category, which is nonetheless, for all of the things we can talk about, is certainly distinct from citizens. And as I mentioned, then we have the millions of Palestinians living in the occupied territories under military law. People who say that it is an apartheid state have pointed to the occupied territories, where, again, there's the wall and the dual road system and the rest of it, which strike people as racist and forced segregation and meaning of apartheid for them. And then there's the refugees. Okay, most Palestinians no longer live within Mandate Palestine, they live outside. Most of them live in refugee camps in the surrounding states. And of course, over the decades, they've made babies, and there's a lot more of them now than there were. Only about 5% of them live here, say, in the States or in Western Europe. Most of them live in the Middle East somewhere, and the great majority live in the frontline states. But there's a million, 6 to 7 million people, depending on who's counting. Or some people go up to 9. I think that modest numbers, 6 to 7 million people. Now, what we found, though, was that when we looked carefully at how these different, these groups, these categories have always been treated as completely separate from each other. Palestinian citizens of Israel have been treated as a separate population, and if they have problems with the state, if they're discriminated against, if there's problems with the administration of land or whatever, this has been treated as a domestic problem of discrimination, which Israel is urged to correct under the laws that pertain to that kind of thing. Palestinians in the occupied territories are not part of that at all. They are part of, they fall under the Fourth Geneva Convention, they fall under the law, international humanitarian law, designed to handle cases of conflict, international conflict. This is, in this model, Israel is the belligerent occupier of these territories. It's presumed that at some point it should withdraw from them, that negotiations about how that withdrawal will happen, exactly how the borders might be adjusted, and so forth, is the name of the game. Within the territories, therefore, the aim has been Israel's withdrawal to allow the creation of a Jewish state. Palestinian state. And the push for a Palestinian state has gained traction in the United Nations and so forth, as some of you may have been following. But that wasn't, what we found though was that if we think about the purpose clause, if we think about Israel's prime directive, I suppose you could say, and we looked at how Israel was handling the question of citizenship and how those laws of discrimination were operating in Israel, we found that Israel's laws have strategically deprived Palestinians from the capacity to change the laws that confirm it as a Jewish state. Palestinians do have the right to vote. But there's a law that says that they cannot have a party with a platform that calls for changing Israel as a Jewish state. So in other words, they can vote for anything but changing that fundamental character of the state. In thinking about this, I came up with an analogy which I'm perfectly ready to be challenged on, but it is a kind of thought experiment. I thought, well, what would it be like if slaves were, we had not had the Civil War, there instead been a process of reforms that had provided rights to decent housing and decent wages and medical care and so forth for slaves, but they couldn't even vote. But they couldn't vote against slavery. They couldn't vote against any change in their own status. That's a tricky analogy, but I think it might be useful here, because what you're doing is you're saying, sure, you can vote, but you can't vote to alter the domination that you experience. And that domination is designed to serve the Jewish people. So this rather undid the idea that Israel is, that the Palestinian citizens of Israel are, don't fit the apartheid model. In fact, the apartheid convention is not written about South Africa. The reference for the study was not South Africa. I lived for 6 years in South Africa. I find the comparison interesting anyway. And in South Africa, they did have a number of adjustments to the law with different groups, so that Indians and coloreds were treated differently from blacks, and some were treated more nicely. And at one point, there was even an effort to have a legislature that let coloreds and Indians vote and didn't let blacks vote. In 1983, which failed, of course. But these variations of treatment, therefore, actually has a precedent in the South African model. That you know, and blacks in Soweto and the townships, blacks in the cities, blacks in the homelands, what we sometimes call Bantustans, all had different laws applying to them as well. So that strategic adjustment on populations, depending on where they are, actually has a precedent here. And that's what we found when we looked at Israel's policies toward Palestinians. Within the state, the Palestinian citizens were circumscribed and prevented from having any capacity for changing the Jewish character of the state through two mechanisms. One is the law I just mentioned, which prevents them from having a political platform to do that. The other is to maintain them as a minority who simply could never muster the votes to do that. And that's been very effective. I think in the last election they had something like, I don't really remember, but it was a tiny fraction of the overall seats in the Knesset. I mean, it's not likely to grow, so that means that they can never get any leverage. So it might as well be seen as serving the Perks Clause. It is seen as serving the Perks Clause. Then you look at the Palestinians in residents of Jerusalem who are in this insecure status, and you see that they are cut off from voting, adding their vote to the votes of Palestinians in Israel. They are in an insecure status, which means that they really can't protest against their situation without risking a great deal, or some do anyway. And then in the third category was Palestinians in the occupied territories who are expressly forbidden to return to their homes inside Israel. Homes and businesses and land and property that they fled in 48-67. Now, of course, there's, Israel will say, well, we can't let them back because of security concerns, but, you know, that kind of creates a circular argument about whether you've actually created the problem that you're defending yourself against, you know, by holding millions of people under occupation. But in any case, what it has done is it's allowed Israel to preserve itself as a Jewish state. And in the last category of the refugees, they're also forbidden to return. It doesn't matter who they are, it doesn't matter what their security status is, it doesn't matter what anything. Okay, whether they have documents showing the land ownership, they're forbidden to return. So all of what we just realized was that these four categories were operating as domains. That's a term in logic. And then here was very useful to thinking about law and policy. It's like legal sub-regimes of a comprehensive regime that was suppressing and dominating Palestinians in their different categories, in different ways, for the same purpose of preserving the Jewish character of the state of Israel. Again, character being that fuzzy word, but having everything to do with demography and law. So this was new. This had never been put together before, this interplay of these four domains, how they work together, how they work in synchronicity, how they are strategically complementary to each other, each creating a dimension of the larger picture, which for the Perks Clause. I'm being attacked by a mosquito if I do strange things here. And I think that was the really innovative part of the report, was to make sense of what had been confusing and contradictory, and it brought together all the pieces of the puzzle. Instead of having one Israel saying, no, we are not an apartheid state because look at the Palestinian citizens of Israel, and other people saying, yes, you are an apartheid state because of the Palestinians and the occupied territories. We said, actually, we need to look at the whole thing together, which was the charge of ESPWA, the Economic and Social Commission of West Asia. They said, we want to know if there's a policy of apartheid regarding the Palestinian people as a whole. So we had to look at all of these populations as part of our mandate. When we did that, it all made sense. Suddenly, all these arguments that had been sailing by each other like ships in the night all made sense. So that was the central finding. And then when you go into the convention, then you look at the kinds of things that Israel is doing. The finding was, yeah, this legally is consistent with apartheid. It's in fact kind of glaringly consistent with apartheid. It's not a hard thing to argue. Unfortunately, I just mentioned as kind of a foreshadowing that because of the sensitivity of the term apartheid, the reaction report pretty much didn't get past the word apartheid. Most of the people I heard from were saying, how dare you call it apartheid, and don't you know about, you know, the Palestinians have the right to vote and things like that. Hadn't read it. They had just reacted to the idea that Israel might be, you know, charged with this terrible crime against humanity, and didn't read the analysis at all. But I think when you do read the analysis, I think you'll see that we took a great deal of care with these points, and of course we're very open to hearing critiques of those arguments. But it does require getting past the scare word, the A word, as some people call it. Okay, I've talked for a while, but I thought I'd wrap up by kind of getting to the so what question. In social science, we can wave our arms and go into all kinds of esoteric discussions, and eventually we have to look around and say, well, so what? And in this case, I think so what falls into two general categories. One of them, it was in the report, which is the legal consequences for member states of the United Nations if they, if in a case, a finding like this, what do they need to do? That's spelled out in the convention. So it wasn't too difficult to write that up. There are obligations to act, to suppress and punish the crime of apartheid, and there's procedures for doing that that are spelled out in the convention, so we laid all that out. We also made a point that this is not a historical question. It's not something we're doing after the fact. It's not 5 years down the road from the Rwandan genocide or something like that where you're trying to assign, you know, blame. It's ongoing. It's happening right this second. And for that reason, it's urgent. And it requires action imperatively. I mean, it really requires that people move on this. Richard Falk and I are both quite interested to see this whole thing go to the International Court of Justice or the International Criminal Court, because they can deliver an authoritative finding. We are two scholars who looked at the law, looked at the situation, and made an analysis. So the highest legal authority in the world system on such matters is the International Court of Justice, and I think that would be great. I think that would be a step, a very important step. I wouldn't want to see that drag out, though. Because living under apartheid is a dreadful situation. It's a dehumanizing, brutal experience. The other part of the so what question has to do with, well, what do we do with all this diplomacy? Right now, the international community is dedicated to a two-state solution. The push in the United Nations for the creation and recognition of a state of Palestine is well on its way. This is something that Dr. Falk and I have thrown back and forth at each other, and we don't agree on it. And we were just having an email exchange about writing a book about where we agree and disagree on this one, which I get a kick out of, because debating with him is always an intellectual challenge and can be very intriguing. But of course, I don't mean to make light of this is a serious moral question, by the way, but I'm just pondering the prospects of writing a book with Richard Falk on this. My position on this is more historic. There's a long history here, and some of you may know that debates, even events like this one, can sometimes get completely bogged down about who did what in 1922 or 1936 or 1947 or whatever. But one thing that has always been clear in Palestine was that partition was unworkable. There was one royal commission back in the 30s that said it was workable, and the crown responded by sending in another more serious group that tromped all around the country and looked at the situation on the ground and came back saying, this is absolutely impossible. He said the only way you could do it is have a complete economic union, because it's such a densely populated area. Even then, it was chock-a-block with people, and land shortages were already a problem for the Palestinian peasantry, which is still, of course, the great majority at that point. And the separation out of any part of the country, particularly if it involved those coastal ports, would be catastrophe unless those borders meant nothing and people just flowed in and out of them as they were used to doing. This vision of partition, though, didn't go away, and routinely called the Zionist movement, was keen on having a Jewish state, and wanted, there was some talk about sharing the land, but the weight of evidence is that the aim, and including diplomacy and public statements by leadership, was that the aim was to have a Jewish state. They believed that that had been promised to them by the original League of Main Nations mandate, and they were therefore wanted partition. I'm sorry, I can't read that.
2 minutes.
No, she's muted.
I assume it's a time card, but I can't read it.
Two lousy weenie minutes.
Okay. What I would say then is. I'll leave all that out because it opens a dreadful amount of stuff. For me, the question arises: if you have a case of apartheid, can you resolve the problem by shifting a border? Can you resolve the problem by partition? We never dreamed of such a thing in South Africa. There was no question about having a white state, a white-dominated state, take form, part of the country, and sustain apartheid in that part of the country. It was apartheid that had to go, not white people or Africaners and their culture or their values. It was apartheid then. And I don't see that it makes, if it is apartheid, I don't see that it makes any sense to try to resolve the conflict through partition that sustains apartheid in part of Mandate Palestine. The way the partition is talking about, I'll just wrap up at this point, there would be two states. One would be a Palestinian state, one would be Israel, as it's currently configured. The Palestinian state is supposed to be a non-ethnic or non-racial democratic state, and Israel would be a Jewish state. If two countries are actually both democratic and not ethnic and not racial, why have a partition? In a land that partition has never been considered to be viable. So I think my closing question is whether the finding of apartheid kind of does end the idea of partition altogether. I would hope that one thing we could talk about is the idea that the Palestinian state forming under these conditions is also most likely to look like a Bantustan. And in fact, We have reason to believe that our response business to South Africa actually picked up a lot of what went into the Oslo Accords from Quebec shortly after that. The way the Palestinian Authority is set up is, compared to the Constitution of Bantustans and the provisions for the Oslo Accords, they're almost the same. So if Bantustan is inherently insecure. It's unstable, insecure, plumbing a literature of violence. So I think the findings of this report, what question, actually go very far. But that's something for much discussion. And right now I would just look forward to your questions. So thank you very much.
You have been listening to Virginia Tilley of the University of Southern Illinois speaking at Harvard University concerning the UN report she authored with Richard Falk titled Israeli Practices Toward the Palestinian People and the Question of Apartheid. And that is our program this morning. We want to especially thank Steve Lowe for his help in producing our program this morning. And thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. To access our permanent archive, go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archive. We hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday to hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.